Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The truth is, I think it was very hard to be Gary. He was complex, at times neurotic, persnickety, high maintenance, a perfectionist with the highest standards, and he could be a handful. Being in his company required extra patience. I think the fact that he spelled his name with two R's was a warning that he was going to be complicated. I don't know why he creates that much trouble for himself.
Hi, I'm Paco Romain.
I'm George Chen.
And you're listening to SupDoc, where we celebrate the good, bad, and ugly of all things documentaries, with insightful interviews, unscripted humor, games, and the occasional horrible impression.
On today's episode, it's the return of Wayne Fetterman, comedian and co-producer of The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. The two-part biography, directed by Judd Apatow, was recently released on HBO.
A longtime friend of Shandling's, Wayne played Larry's brother Stan on the groundbreaking series The Larry Sanders Show. We also find out he was part of the storied Sunday basketball game that Shandling hosted at his home.
Wayne's credits include Transparent, Seinfeld, 40-Year-Old Virgin, head monologue writer for Fallon, and much, much more. He teaches comedy history at USC and wrote a book about Pistol Pete Maravich.
And now, here's our talk with Wayne Fetterman. So we are here to talk about the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling doc on HBO.
Yep. Two-parter.
Two-parter. There are emperors who haven't had a documentary this long dedicated to them. Essentially, what a love letter to Gary Shandling.
In a way it is. And before we even begin, I'd like to say that I was a co-producer of that, which is like the lowest level of producer you can be. So there were people that were way more involved with this documentary.
Right.
You know, Sam, who was the producer of it, and obviously Judd, who, you know, conceptualized the whole thing, and Joe, the editor, were just like way, like, sure. How far out?
Yeah.
Like space, the final frontier out.
Yeah.
Compared to, I just don't want to seem like I'm taking credit for something that I was involved with, but.
Right. Right, remember, but you weren't extremely hands-on.
No, not through the whole process.
It's the way I'm a co-host on this show. Actually,
right, yeah,
it's very
yeah.
much
you know what it feels
similar.
Like.
Yes, I do.
I'm sorry. I just don't want to come off as like, oh, this is somebody produced. Like, yeah. I mean, yes, it says that, but
how many points did you get on the back end for this? That's what's more interesting.
You know how much money documentaries make.
Tons.
Why do you think I have this new house?
Yeah,
look around.
This is
look
the
around.
Wing that documentaries made.
Right.
But you were a part of it.
No question. And, no, right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right from the get-go.
And you knew Gary.
Very well.
That's,
very well.
When did you... Do you remember what year you met old Mr. Shandling?
Well, it was... Okay, yeah. Before we even get to that, can I address the love letter part?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Please.
Because I feel like this documentary, we didn't want it to be a love letter. So the fact that you feel like it's just all love for this guy...
Yeah.
I thought it was... We were going for more like... This is humanity. This is a creative guy with flaws, and obviously he fires his girlfriend after he breaks up with her.
Yes.
And he's, you know, the situation with Alan's Wybell, where they're not even talking at the end of its Gary Shandling show. So I really thought the whole thing was very much not... I've seen very affectionate documentaries, many of them, and I thought it was in the... I thought it celebrated his life, but I don't know if it was a love letter.
Got it.
Do you think I'm overreacting? You think I'm too sensitive?
Neither. It just seems to me when you're like someone who has the relationship that Judd had with Gary,
yes.
It's going to be warts and all, and it's still, to me, a love letter.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It's like made affectionately, but he wasn't trying to hide any of the...
What do you also think love letter?
I didn't think... it's really hard when someone has passed on. And like, it's just most of the time when you do a documentary on someone who's passed on, like... it's not the way that, let's say, almost every sports documentary almost is too glowing about people.
Right, 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 right.
And so I didn't think it was like, let's say, like compared to like the Andre the Giant thing, where you almost don't get this interior sense of this guy's life. I mean, I think there's a sense that he is the hardest person on himself. That really comes across.
Yeah, right,
so in that sense, I didn't really, I wouldn't say that when I tell people about it, I think it's more interesting just like the struggles that he was internally having. So in that sense, I don't find it to be that much. But maybe because it is filtered through a Judd lens, I think is maybe the part of it that you're picking up on in terms of love letter. But when I've talked to people about it, I haven't said that it's a love letter. But I do think it's like, it's not necessarily like,
is it
let's
a letter?
Fixate on the negative at
is
all.
It, is it a letter?
It is like, HBO makes letters, right? That's what they do now.
It's essentially a letter.
I like a four-hour letter I just got from HBO.
It's not the love part. It's the letter part that really bugs me that you keep bringing up.
I mean, to put it in another context, because we're here at your place, and we just picked up like his memorial guidance. Like, you wouldn't be like, man, that memorial guide should have really exposed more of his warts.
No,
you wouldn't do that.
Well, it's yes. That was a little different, but okay. That's all I wanted to say. Yeah. I wanted to address that. Your question was, when did I meet Gary?
Yeah,
I first auditioned for the show before I had ever met him. In fact, I was just going through. As you can see, I have a lot of my life here that I'm sort of going through.
Saw some yearbooks over here.
Yeah, there's yearbooks all day from South Plantation High School. But this is. I came across a ticket. I went to a taping of It's Gary Shandling Show before it ever aired.
Wow.
In 1986, in the summer of 86. And it came out, I think, in the fall of 86, if I'm not mistaken, on Showtime. And I didn't have Showtime. I couldn't afford Showtime at that.
Yeah.
So, I don't remember much about the episode, but I do remember, unlike any other television taping I've ever been to, a warm-up comic, just a band... in between sets.
That was my question. Who was the warm-up comic for Gary
Shandling? Yeah. Sorry. Well,
that's interesting.
I know.
Seeing that Gary was a stand-up comic.
I know, but I think I kind of remember him riffing a lot on the set, and that would sort of warm him up and get him going a little bit. But anyway, just an interesting side. So that was the first time I saw him in person. Mm-hmm. And then, I had known from The Tonight Show, mainly, was how I knew him. I didn't know that Mike Nesmith's show. I didn't.
Wait, he did Mike Nesmith's show too?
Yes.
I know, I remember Bobcat did Mike Nesmith's show.
Yeah.
I remember Bobcat feeding a bacon to a pig. That's what I remember from that show.
That makes sense. Mike Nesmith from the Monkees.
Yeah, yes. He produced Repo Man, and he also invented music videos, according to Mike Nesmith.
Of course.
He lives in Santa Cruz now. I don't know why I know all this stuff about the Monkees.
Interesting.
Love the Monkees.
If you don't know Mike Nesmith, he was the one with the hat.
Right. Yeah. He was the talented one. Wasn't he like...
I thought Michael Dolenz is very talented.
I think they all had some talents, but he's the
Davy
one that...
Jones was on Broadway. What are you talking about?
He's the only one that produced Repo Man. That's all I have to say.
It's just a love letter to the Monkees is all I'm saying.
Again, with the letters.
I can't help myself. Mm-hmm. George Harrison is credited with like... bringing about the modernization of British films. So maybe there was something, because he financed the Monty Python films
did. Oh, yeah. I knew there was some connection between the Beatles and the Pythons, but I didn't know totally.
They know, like, the Bonzo Ruddles, Dog if band. I'm not mistaken.
Yes, the Ruddles.
This is crazy.
Yeah. Do you guys like the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band? You know that stuff? Yeah. That's sort of like crossover.
The Ruddles, though.
The Ruddles. Yeah.
The Ruddles is amazing.
Yeah.
I remember
Gilda's in that, right?
Oh, really?
I think.
Oh, the film. Yes. Possibly in the film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, guys, we're writing so many love letters today.
Yeah, we are.
I'm sorry. We're going off a little bit.
No, that's fine.
But in a weird way, I feel when Judd saw the George Harrison two-part Scorsese documentary, I think that I'm speaking again.
Right.
Someone who's worked, that part of it was like, I think he saw it like that when he started putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, as deep a dive as that.
Right.
It's a very deep dive.
It's a dive. It's not a letter. It's a dive.
Yeah, it's more of a deep dive. It's more of a dive.
Like we're going snorkeling into the Shandling world.
So
I auditioned for the show. for there was an episode where there was a bunch of Jews. Like, I guess Hank became Jewish or something.
Oh, for the Larry Sanders show.
Yes, yeah. So.
Yeah, he tries to convert.
Yes. So there's executives that, I don't know. So I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But I saw him at the audition. And then about that time, I auditioned for the brother and started playing basketball at the same time.
That's really...
Which came first? Getting
the role?
That's
a good... I know it sounds like, oh, I play basketball. But he was very, like, adamant about, like, the basketball game was, like, sort of this show business free zone.
Right.
Where he was like, if you were trying to, like, angle it or anything like that, he would sniff those guys out immediately.
And you wouldn't be asked back. I remember, I don't know how long ago this was, but it was when I had fantasies of being a comedian and actor, and I read in a newspaper article that golf was no longer the sport of Hollywood, and it was now basketball.
Oh.
And if you wanted to, like, rub elbows with the echelon of the executive producer types and directors and actors, that you had to play basketball. And I'm a basketball player, and I was like, oh, this is my in. This is my in. And it specifically mentioned how Gary had a famous basketball game that we'd play every weekend. And it also mentioned that caveat that he wouldn't let people talk about the business.
It wasn't he wouldn't let, but I think he had an antenna that was like, and this is about me for 1 second.
Please.
For 1 second. Good God. Enough about Gary Chandler. That the whole time I played basketball right until the end, and you can see, I never realized that it was Gary trying to create this familial
family.
Something.
Love letter.
And that I was just there to have a good time.
Yeah.
But like, it was really important to him that he built this house. He built that court. And every Sunday, I mean, he had catered sometimes from Jones on Third, or sometimes pizza. And like, it was a thing.
That's
awesome. It was a real. And so I don't know. Now when we were making the documentary, it was like, oh, this was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's just how oblivious I am to things, and
Right.
Other people's inner.
Yeah.
There was a guy who was trying to make a film about just those Sundays only basketball games.
Yeah.
And then I guess that's when he had to go in for the surgery.
Yeah.
That kind of got put on the outs. So a lot of footage. I imagine there's a lot more footage of the basketball.
There's not
stuff.
That much more, because we didn't shoot. We didn't really shoot the game that much, and so
I was kind of surprised it's just a half court.
I know.
I thought for sure it was like a full court.
I tried to convince him. I tried to
To make a full court?
I tried to make, or at least have two baskets.
Two baskets.
We could have two games going on, and then the winners go.
Right. Because you can only really
wouldn't listen to me.
Yeah.
That's the point of this podcast. The guy would not listen to me.
Make me a full producer.
Tell us why Gary was so stubborn.
Gary would not listen. It was gorgeous. I mean, it was down. Like, the house was kind of a street level. And then the court was sort of went down this little pathway to get to it.
Yeah.
And it was isolated by trees. It was incredible.
Did you meet anyone playing those games that, like, you became good friends with just outside of the game?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it went everywhere from, like, comedian guys that Gary knew to, to me, the greatest game I ever played was once Bob Costas played in the game.
No.
It gets even better. So, Bob Costas, I'm kind of tall, but I'm, like, in a way trans because I'm, like, I'm like a guard trapped in a forward's body.
Right. So, you got do you have handles?
Send the go ahead, attack.
Tweet.
So I'm trapped in a forward's body, but I'm a guard. I like to I don't like to bang anything.
Yeah.
So Costas was like, go down. You get down in the paint.
We need our big man down.
He was so adamant. I was like,
I don't do that. Yeah.
I can't play any. But the best part was after the game, because it's on Sundays, we would be watching football with Gary. And then Costas was talking about the football game. I'm like, okay, that's the voice that should be coming out of the TV.
That's insane. That's insane. That's I'm surprised you didn't try to get an elbow into that pretty face of his. Like, fucking Bob Costas.
No. He was.
That's awesome.
He was scrappy. He was pretty good.
Was he?
Yeah. What,
5'5", 5'6"?
Okay. I don't know.
I'm just wondering. He seems like a short man.
Yeah. I guess he was mad at me for being tall and not taking advantage of it. Like, he would be like, if I had your 6'2" inches.
I've played in those games where big guys just want to shoot threes, and you're just like, what are you doing? We need you to rebound.
So you agree with Costas?
Yes. I got actually.
You.
Yeah.
You're attacking me. And that's our podcast.
I know nothing about basketball, which explains my status in the entertainment world also. Yeah. Oh, wow.
He checks out when we talk sports.
And I'm just like,
Okay, can I say something about my new house?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real quickly. Really, yeah. And then we'll get into
half court. Out back.
No. Oh, I don't. Awesome. There's no back. that I am going to get a Xbox. I've never gamed at all in my life.
Yeah.
So I assume this is part of. No.
Oh, for me?
Yeah.
No, you've been to my place. I don't.
Never mind that. Never mind.
I'm excited about Rampage. Weirdly, I played that game on like an old PC, but yeah. I'm not a big game guy.
Okay.
I have PS4. Okay.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Get a PS4.
Okay.
I think.
Well, let's talk after.
Yeah, yeah.
And let's go back to Gary.
And you're getting a piano. Also, you're going to get a piano in here.
Oh, there's going to be a piano.
Oh,
right there.
Oh, nice.
Where that
baby grand.
Probably going to be a baby grand.
Upright?
Yes, an upright baby grand.
Yeah.
A diagonal piano. It'll be on a diagonal 45 degree angle.
You know, they still make those, don't they?
But guys, thanks for coming to the house. I'm serious.
Are we your first guests?
In a way, yes.
Oh,
I mean, two. Nice. Like,
well,
three.
The guy setting up the internet is always here first.
Yeah. Spectrum.
So you first met Gary at the audition.
At the audition.
And then you did get a part on the show.
Didn't get a part on the show as his brother.
Right.
And then I think when that happened, he was like, do you want to play in this game? And Judd was still playing in the game at the time. So I knew him. So kind of through Judd, I guess, was like, yeah.
I was really surprised. I did not know the story of Judd interviewing comedians when he was a teenager.
You didn't?
I didn't
That's
know
that.
That's his claim to fame.
Yeah,
they
played him on Marin before too. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That was his thing. He was like the first comedy nerd, right? He was like doing like basically like a fanzine but interviewing comedians
100%.
When he was like in high school.
That's amazing. And and the fact that they still had the cassette taped. It says like Judd interviews Gary something.
You see I'm a little bit Judd has everything he ever
Everything.
Yeah.
Wow.
It reminds me that I used to listen to this radio show in San Francisco, and I got an interview with Greg Proops.
Oh.
But I don't remember if I had it on tape.
Mm.
I remember calling him at a personal number and like asking him some really generic high school question. This is when I was
Did
in high
you transcribe
school.
It?
I never ran it anywhere. I'm wondering if I have notes like somewhere of like just me asking Greg Proops some dumb questions.
Right. The smartest man in the world.
I mean, he was accessible.
Was he the smartest man back then?
Well, to me, everyone was smarter. I mean, I was in high school, junior high.
No, I'm saying,
high.
Was he billing himself?
No, I don't think he was in the San Francisco days. I think it must have been post going to England or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, a bunch of these people I used to listen to in San Francisco. I just like ran. I met like Carrie Snow the other day. I was just like, I used to listen to you like when I was in junior high.
She's
like, oh my God, I'm doing my 40th anniversary of stand-up in Throckmorton. I'm like, oh geez.
Oh, wow. What was it? Alex Bennett?
That was the show I grew up listening to. Did you have a similar type of show that you grew up listening to?
That? There was nothing quite. Other there was like some redneck radio stations that played like this, some stupid sketch stuff I would listen to. But
I didn't have anything like that. When I was a kid, I was very much had. There was two shows on Sunday night. Speaking of Sunday, back to back, Dr. Demento National Lampoon. And so this is before SNL. This is early, like 73, 74. And so that's when I first learned about Belushi and all of those guys from that.
Right.
That was nationally syndicated?
Yep.
Oh, I didn't know
I got it in Florida.
And you were a musical.
South Plantish.
South Plantish.
We're looking at my yearbook right now.
And you're kind of like a music comedy guy, too. So like Demento must have been a huge thing for you.
At the time, I wasn't that music. Demento was amazing. It was, I just felt like, okay, this is something I love and listen to it. That was a back-to-back syndication package.
I think that National Lampoon doc is a love letter, that brilliant, drunk, crazy stuff. We were going to do that
one
at some point.
Yeah. That's a great, It's a very interesting documentary. It's mm-hmm. very long, but it's also very interesting. There's a lot of stuff I didn't know about mm-hmm. that organization.
Guys, I don't know what is going on, but I mean, I do know what's going on. There's a crazy comedy boom happening, yeah. and we're right in the middle of it.
Yeah, we are right in the middle.
Are we at the middle or the end? You bought a house, so let's hope we're in the middle.
We're in the middle, yeah. We're definitely, I think we're in the middle.
For sale.
Get out. There's a sheriff at the door.
I'm going to need that refrigerator box back.
I'll be living. Very good. Very good.
Yeah, that's awesome. Who was the first like modern day musical comedian? I mean, there was like Victor Borge. Didn't he do like comedy mm-hmm. and Borge, stuff?
Yeah.
Was Dudley Moore, would you think, would he be
yes,
like?
Yes, 100%.
I yeah. think the well, British.
Beyond the Fringe, have you ever seen the footage of Beyond the Fringe?
Never seen footage of it. I've heard some of the audio.
Oh, they have, yeah. all, they have it all, and it's incredible. And he does... He does a couple piano routines, but the best one to me is the classical music song that doesn't end. Mm-hmm. So it's like all you
does
think,
he pause dun, and then keep going? Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun, dun, dun, it's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible.
I noticed that like, there is like a really deeper tradition in England of like their music hall comedy. Mm-hmm. So they really like funny songs and stuff have been like an ongoing thing.
I mean, of course.
Obviously in America there was as well, but it's like was more of like an active tradition, I think, up through like the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
But there was also Spike Jones did music. Oh, right. And there was some other... Oh, Tom Lehrer, of course.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah, Henry Youngman had a violin, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Who is the Mark Russell? Who's the guy?
Oh, Mark Russell,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, Mike Russell.
Yeah. Didn't he do like
here's
political...
Here's a song about Lee Atwater. Yeah.
But it was always like... songs from like the 1800s. It's all like Yankee Doodle, Atwater.
Ronald Reagan went to town. Yeah. So you knew Gary and you mm-hmm. helped co-produce this documentary, but was there anything in it that surprised you didn't know about Gary Shandling?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I didn't know. I mean, there was a lot now that I'm thinking about it, but I didn't know that the reason he found out that Brad Gray was doing some shenanigans was because they were doing discovery in his lawsuit against his girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Like that was the thing. They were like, oh, you don't want to see this information. Like, well, no, I think we do. And that was the start of this incredible falling out that ruined his relationship with Bob Saget and a number of people.
Right.
Yeah. So
that was just like figuring out the financial stuff with like
yes,
Brad
Gray. That Brad Gray was like, we're not going to let you discover anything.
And this has come up, I think, with musicians too. It's like you don't want your manager to also be your label because there's inherently a conflict of interest. Like, came up a couple times with musicians
and access to your bank account. Like mm-hmm. you don't want that.
I feel like a lot of people are not savvy about showbiz money stuff.
Yeah.
And I know why that might be the case, but it seems
especially that generation where I think a lot of people grew up really poor mm-hmm. and then got into show business, made some money, and they're just like...
Are you talking about musicians now?
Musicians and comedians.
Well, I think the musicians getting ripped off is a longer-running story.
Right, yeah.
I mean, even Billy Joel. I mean, it was like Billy Joel. It's not like, oh, you expect it with those, blues guys who didn't know what they were
Johnson
doing. Yeah. But,
Billy Joel famously, didn't his manager take everything?
And he had to release an album, and he goes to L.A. and plays in the lounge rather than...
To digress a little bit, have you heard Van Morrison's contractual obligation record that he made? Oh, it's great. It's basically he was stuck in a contract. He had to make a record as Van Morrison, and he just, like, it sounds like a Jandek record. He's basically, like, he's just, like, strumming, like, one note and just, like, muttering, like, worms. The worms are going to eat you. Like, I got to find you this Van Morrison thing. It's pretty amazing.
When I worked for a record label in San Francisco, and we had this guy under a contract as well that he didn't want to do, and he sent in a cassette tape. It sounded like him playing on a desk with spoons. That was about it. And he was like, there you go. Put that out.
On your trance label.
Yeah, exactly. I was surprised to find out he was an engineer. I didn't know that about Gary.
Oh, yeah. And I knew he was an engineering student, but I think the discipline and the mental agility that he possessed and sort of nurtured in engineering really helped him a lot in stand-up.
Mm-hmm. Well, he seemed to be super focused on his joke writing
even to the end. I mean, right to the end, there's just reams of paper of jokes, ideas. Then this,
Do you think it takes that kind of dedication and work ethic to be one of the greats? Or is it, on the opposite side of that question is like, can you be one of the greats without that kind of dedication and work ethic? You know, like,
I don't think so. I mean, when you think about it, like, I mean, certainly Carlin had it and Seinfeld to an extent, and like, they don't come along that way. And, you know, I'm going to bring up Louis C.K., and I'm sorry if I'm triggering somebody who doesn't know the story.
I think it's fine.
You know, I think those guys just, I mean, think what Louis C.K. created over those 5 years. Like, three specials, a television show.
Right.
You know, it was insane.
Actually, when you bring up, like, the engineering stuff, I did think about this story is, like, where Louis would just, like, pick up a computer off the street and then just, like, figure it out. Or he was, like, an AV guy. Like, I think he was, like, a high school AV guy.
Well, I could thread a projector.
But, like, that kind of, like, it ties in a little bit to, like, that kind of mentality of, like, an engineering person or someone who can, like, reverse it. I think a lot of comedy is reverse engineering.
That's interesting. So tell me what that means.
Like it's taking something and just breaking it down into its components, and reconfiguring it. So, or, like, looking at something from a slightly different perspective. So, in a way, it's, like, reverse. And also, like, maybe because I just listen to comedy all the time, I'm just like, oh, like, how did they must have, like, taken a premise and then, like, broken it down and then just reassembled it. That's kind of that kind of mentality, which an engineer has.
Yeah.
Or, like,
right.
You know,
that makes sense.
And which I don't have because I was not good at any of that stuff.
So. I mean, sometimes I think you start with the.
Well, you were good at basketball, right?
Yeah, I remember that. Fundamentals. I knew the fundamentals.
Yeah, you always flip. You always have the L.
I'm pivoting constantly. Yeah. I'm always pivoting.
You're right. The swan, as my coach would call it.
I was never good at any sport except once when we played soccer and it was just like the goal was only like a bench turned on its side. I'm like, I'll just lay in front of it. I'm just going to get reamed in the nuts. It'll be fine.
I was also a little, I mean, I knew like Gary was into like meditation, but I didn't realize how big of a part of that is life.
Well, I think Sarah said the key statement almost of the documentary, which was that Gary was searching for Zen calmness, not because he was Zen, because he was in desperate need of finding some peace.
Right.
And I don't know if he ever found it. And even at the very beginning, I know we don't show the clip of it, but what Bill Maher says about him was like, I don't know if he was ever really at peace. Right. I don't know if he was ever happy. It was hard to tell. He was searching, always looking for something. So, and I agree with that. I do think he was, at times, you know, when he was playing ball, sure. He seemed like he was just having a great time and when he was on stage, but he was troubled.
Yeah, like even the way he gets into Buddhism is almost like with that kind of same like total 110% enthusiasm that he got into everything else. It's like Buddhism, let me go down a tunnel to the point like I'm getting this tattoo on my neck and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I don't know, I assume it's because Tom Petty passed away as well at the same age, mm-hmm. both at 66. That their scenes together are just...
I love those.
They're transcendent.
Yeah.
Because they're just talking shop and they come down after a show and it's just... God, it is just beautiful. And it's affectionate and it's weird, you know, and it's just...
Two masters at their craft too, you know? Like these are two guys that really got their craft down.
Unbelievable.
Like, yeah. Yeah, that scene in Tom Petty's studio where they're hanging out is hysterical. Did he live... I don't know if you know this, but did he live near Gary?
I think they'd lived up in the hills. I wasn't there for that because I was kind of involved a little bit with those.
The DVD stuff?
Yeah, the DVD stuff. So, now I don't know. I wasn't there.
Yeah. I don't know why I got this impression. It was just from watching them. I feel like they're neighbors.
Well, that's what's so amazing about those DVD specials. I think we talked about that, the DVD extras. Mm-hmm. We were talking about that a little bit. So you helped produce some of that
stuff? Yeah, I was very... I mean, I don't have a co-producer credit or anything. But yeah, it was very much of right... There's like footage of like our initial pitch meeting to Sony to do it. Like we were shooting that and... Like it took 2 years. It took a long time to put that together.
Yeah.
Maybe three.
Wow.
Maybe 3 years.
Because the Larry Sanders Show was 6 years
in a run? I think it was.
Till 98 or so?
Yeah, I think it's 92 to 98. That's right. That's right.
And what a, like, oh man, what a groundbreaking show. Do you think, this is another weird question, but do you think his two shows, the Gary Shanley Show and the Larry Sanders Show, like invented the single camera sitcom thing? Okay.
No, because MASH was doing single camera, and that MASH was hugely popular.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. That's true. Good point.
But I think it did. I mean, certainly the using the celebrities themselves and
breaking the fourth wall
in a way. Larry didn't really. Larry Sanders never talked to the camera.
No. Yeah. But the first show, right? Yeah. Which I didn't really watch the first show.
I loved it.
But, yeah,
I taped it, and my friends and I would have like sleepovers or whatever, and we'd watch it because our parents wouldn't let us.
You loved it, huh?
I loved it. Paul Wilson. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, fucking
loved that dude. I loved it because he was so weird. Mm-hmm. And Gary seemed like a kid. He seemed like a teenager on that show because he was so weird and so goofy.
It was weird. I know Conan loves that show.
Oh,
also.
I bet. Yeah. It seems like smart and silly, which is one of my favorite. That's my favorite comic genre.
100%. That's what that show was.
Yeah. And he'd be like the next day and he'd pull out a turkey that was like already eaten. You know, he'd show time passage that way. And like,
but even the clip we show in the documentary of him going through.
The sets and stuff. Yeah,
it's just incredible. It's,
That's funny. He's like, Studio City's 10 minutes away from the ocean, or you could walk through these Christmas trees and it's 7 feet away.
I like those scenes where, like you were saying, so there was no warm-up comic, but when he's just like, I'm sure the producer's just like, well, you're just going to keep riffing? You're not rolling yet?
And of course, he said, like, I got to do the riffing. Tonight Show next week from Monday or something.
Yeah. You've got an audience here. I might as well try.
I didn't realize that period of time, it was like he had a whole sitcom that he was running at the same time that he was guest hosting Tonight Show.
Right.
And I'm like, that is like pretty much like all your dreams come true. And like, be careful what you wish for. Like,
100%?
It's just like too much goodness happening.
Yeah, and he was, he was good at it, and I think he would get really disappointed if he didn't have a certain standard that he went up to.
For both. He didn't want to half-ass either of them, is what I think
it
seemed like.
It's his name on the show. Mm-hmm. I mean, it couldn't have been more personal.
Yeah, absolutely. And when someone has, like, the level of anxiety that Gary Shandling seemed to have, like, that just...
That came through, huh?
Yeah. It's only because I've watched a lot of docs. I'm pretty good now of the language of documentaries. But, like, when you have that much anxiety and that much the inability to realize your self-worth that it seemed like he had, like, you don't feel like you're worth that much success.
I think he liked his stand-up. I really do. I think he did, and I think he struggled with his acting a little bit.
Yeah.
And he, he found Roy eventually, but we found it's not in the documentary, but it might be eventually an old resume of his, and he had studied with another acting guy before Roy, this guy, Milton Castellas, who was
sounds like a hard ass.
Okay, how could you even, from his name?
Because someone named Milton Castellas is a guy who's going to be like, get off my stage.
No, but he was the Scientologist was part of his thing. Yeah, so I know he was really, and this is something Gary told me once, that early on in his career, some casting director said, you're not a good actor.
Whoa.
Like, so I
that
know.
That stick in his craw, yeah, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing to hear, especially
really
when you're,
hard.
And so I think all of those shows, he created an environment where he could shine the most as an actor. And I think that served him.
I don't remember him sleeping. His work was his life. And I felt that as close as we became, to a great extent, I was auditioning still. Auditioning as a person.
To not hurt him.
To not hurt him.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you.
I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Being told by a casting director that you can't act is like a nightmare scenario, at least for me, man. Like, yeah, going into an audition, I mean, a casting director be like, you know what? Maybe you should be a cook or something.
Oh. Right.
Maybe you're better off being something
else.
But
I have to say, I feel like Gary, in that engineering way, like when he started doing stand-up at the Comedy Store, Mitzi passed him, but she didn't like what he was doing at all. So he was able to, like, I'm going to work my way through this. I'm going to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Mitzi, R.I.P.
Yes, who just passed away last week.
Yeah.
And then the same one with his casting director. Like, you can't act? Okay, well, mm-hmm. I'll go to acting class. Okay, this was, you asked me, was there a surprise? I never knew he took dance class. Like, right. He learned that from Meryl Marco.
Yeah, right. That's
who was
right.
doing stand-up around town at the same time.
And the
improv. He was in an improv group a little bit.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
so he was really stretching, mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm an engineer. What do I have to do to be a stand-up comedian?
Yeah.
I have to be comfortable on stage. I have to be this, have to write great jokes, have to...
Right.
And he, like...
Dance class is a great way to, like, yeah,
and
work
improv,
through your body.
I don't know why stand-up comics have such a weird thing about improv.
Because it costs money.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
maybe because
one.
You have to take classes.
Oh, right. You mean the divide between the two?
Yeah.
I think that's less now than it was.
It should be, because improv is a wonderful tool to, like, get into all that stuff.
True. Yeah.
Sidebar. Have you seen, I know it sounds like the hackiest thing in the world, and it's one of the best things I've ever seen, the Improv Shakespeare Company.
Oh.
They're at Largo right now.
Nice.
Just, it's a recommendation.
We're going to leave it at that.
Okay. LA recommendation.
Okay. It sounds like, oh, this is the worst kind of,
right.
Please get me out of here.
Iambic pentameter.
All over the place.
Is
it's good.
Beyond good.
Ooh, I want to see it.
It is thrilling comedy.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the best improv groups I've ever seen was out of, I think, UCB here. Mm-hmm. I saw them at Sketchfest one year in San Francisco, and it was a series. It was a showcase of improv groups, and it went from just horrific to the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life.
I feel like that's the problem with improv.
It is.
Sometimes the same show is like that.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, of course it is.
But I guess every stand-up show is like that.
But
well,
Gary
not
was,
everyone.
Gary was willing. The thing is, like, when you have that thirst, I guess, and you have that passion, you're just like, you know what? Fuck it. If you tell me I'm not good enough, I'm going to go learn how to be good
enough. I think that was another thing I gleaned from it then. I only knew Gary as the successful comedian.
Right. Oh, yeah.
From the Tonight Show. I mean, everyone remembers that first Tonight Show with the pen and all of that. And so... But it was like, looking back, I know you want to call it reverse. I don't know if it's engineering or reverse engineering, but it's very logical, methodical. Keep my head down. This is what I need to do this.
Yeah.
That comes
and
across.
And achieved incredible levels.
Oh, my God, yes.
I think
quickly, too.
Yeah, we had just talked about his hurly-burly acting. Right. That was the thing, I think, that when we stopped was like that film. And then, you know, it was great to see him, like, just stretching out more and, like, doing something like he's an Iron Man, like, just
Iron Man. He was great. And
he was great.
He was really good in Iron Man.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of something I learned from the DVD extras, going back to the Larry Sanders Show DVD extras, that he had Sharon Stone in there. And I remember watching that extra where it's like him and Sharon Stone, like, reminiscing. They met in an acting class.
In Roy's class.
Roy's class.
Yeah.
And I guess dated, or this sort of implied that they had something going on, and like they're watching this footage of themselves, and like she like just grabs his hand. It's like, we were so young.
Oh,
and like it was such a like a really, I remember that from that DVD extras. And like they really made that into, I mean, I guess you and everyone who worked on that, those were really, really amazing, like insights into Gary. And just like
Gary, that DVD in a way is the most revealing thing he ever did, more than the Larry Sanders Show.
Right.
Because it's under the guise of, I want to go back and re-examine this monolith that I created that everyone loved and what was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, he wanted to break down all of those artifices.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw how Carol Burnett reacted to it. She was like, this is the weirdest interview. I don't even know what's going on.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. And then the Gervais thing happens.
Oh, we got to talk about the Gervais thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's, Lord. There's a lot. Yeah.
There's a lot going.
Yeah.
And
I read a review of that Gervais thing that was just like, he's trying to actually, you know, school him a little bit in a way.
Gary is.
Yeah, where like, and it's just clearly like not, he's not picking up on it. He's just like, try not thinking. It's like... Like a little squirrel, like,
yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah.
How do I not think?
Well, like, it's kind of weird because Ricky obviously he looks up to Gary Shanley, but also has this weird arrogance about it. Or it's a weird teeter-totter of status changes. That keep going.
Okay, that's interesting. Status, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the, yes, yeah. And I feel like how you view that interview is a reflection more of you than of them. Because some people are just like, well, Gary is the biggest a-hole in the world. This guy is not even giving him a chance to connect with them.
Right.
And other people are like, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. This next level guy. He wanted, you talk about cringe comedy.
Yeah.
This is in real life cringe comedy. Yeah.
Wait.
And then other people are like, Gary's just trying to maybe bring this guy in and show him another level of where he could go. Mm-hmm.
Well, he had just created one of the biggest TV shows ever, you know, Ricky at that point.
Yes,
and
no question.
So I can imagine he'd have some hubris and just being like, yeah, we're on the same level. And Gary's like, I've been in the business now 30 years. I was with Tonight Show.
Also, like, just he wasn't expecting him to be in the house.
Right.
That's
part,
the number
the
one
kitchen
thing.
Part. Oh,
he's just
man.
Like, there's a camera in my kitchen.
Kitchen.
Let's not do.
We don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Terrible impression.
And you really got to see a little of the Shanling anger.
Yeah.
In that, which I'm glad was in it.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it was pretty infamous, and you wouldn't want to be on the opposite end of that, you know?
Of course.
Yeah, you don't want to be on the receiving end. And then there's lots of people.
Withering, I think we'd say. Withering?
Yeah.
Withering.
Yeah, you saw Ed Solomon's story.
Yeah.
You know, he... he wrote Bill and Ted's, right?
Yeah.
And Men in Black. And so he was like, I was really worried.
Yeah.
When I said
why
this show isn't working on the level.
So, Mr. Shanley, if I could, it's like, I don't know what. And then he was like, that's a really good idea. And he's like, whew, Jesus.
Jesus Christ, I'd live another day.
Oh, the entertainment business. It's daunting. But yeah, the Ricky Gervais interview. Now people are like, they're sharing it, you know.
Oh, right.
Because they're like...
It's interesting. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
It's really... Again, I feel like it's a Rorschach. Am I saying that correctly?
Rorschach?
Say it again.
Rorschach.
Okay, yeah. Rorschach. I feel like it is a Rorschach test, how you view that.
Mm, interesting.
Like, what a piece of garbage this guy is, or... Again.
Well, what do you think? What's your opinion on that? What's your Rorschach?
It's a podcast.
What's your ink blot?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what to, I think Gary was mad at him, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I thought he was really angry. Well, yeah. And it took him a long time
to
settle down and then find some kind of common ground comedically to reach on. And then, but because I saw in Ricky Gervais, I know you call him Gervais.
Yeah.
I think that's wrong. but
remember, tweet at Wayne Fetterman.
No, it's just at Fetterman. It's that he did one with Larry David that was fine. They just they were funny and they riffed and it was like it was easy going and I don't know. I don't know. It's just Gary being a unique guy who wanted to be authentic.
Yeah. Well, I think
I wasn't afraid of any of that.
If I may project,
wasn't afraid of coming off bad. Wasn't afraid of none of the stuff that most people are like
trying to hide.
Whatever. You just want to be friendly and nice.
Yeah.
Even if the guy was in your kitchen and you didn't want him there or looking through your fridge.
It seems like he was on a journey to always be his authentic self, though. So it's like maybe he doesn't want to hide when the bullshit comes up. He's like, this is me.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it, you know? Like,
I know. It's scary.
It is scary.
It's scary.
There's a thing.
Were you ever afraid of upsetting Gary at any point?
Not really, because he was... but I did a couple times accidentally, and
unintentionally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't nice. And I saw his
it came at you.
I saw it go over at other people too, where it was like, mm-hmm. oh, thank God that's not me. Mm-hmm. And it came at me a couple times, but we had a very easygoing, fun, comedic relationship. Basically, I was there playing basketball, and then I was like his plus one for all these events he got invited to. So it was
really?
Like Rat, the premiere of that. Maybe 20 premieres I went to with
wow,
that guy.
Oh, with Gary?
Yeah, because I'm like an easygoing guy, yeah, yeah. So it was never a thing, and I could go off. I wasn't needy, and
yeah.
So it was very. I was always like very grateful.
Oh my God, I bet that's
lucky. It's in there. The very first Wayne Federman International Film Festival was Gary. He was the one. I told him of the idea, and he was like, "I love it. I want to do it." Oh, well, that's the reason the festival exists.
Really,
in a way. Yeah.
Did you show a film that he was in?
No, this is the way this festival works is I pick a comedian and they show a film they love or were inspired by. And so he showed The King of Comedy.
The
1983.
So
but
good.
If you really think about it, and the reason he showed it was it informed the Larry Sanders Show because there was
the talk show.
The backstage. Yeah. And then.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And they shot I think they shot her on video, the actual footage of the Jerry Langford show.
Oh,
I think that's the way they worked it. And so I think Gary even saw that it was like, oh, it's just even the texture of film against this
video.
Adds an...
Jesus Christ.
And that's really what the Larry Sanders Show was.
It really is.
Right?
Oh, my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah. So...
Ah, that's fucking brilliant.
I know.
We're done
this podcast. Yeah, we're done, right?
Should we go to the question?
Like speaking of, bringing up the film festival.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
listener question. We had someone ask.
What's his name or her name?
It's Mark.
Mark. I thought it was a guy.
Mark Hershon.
Yeah. Mark Hershon. You know Mark? Yeah, that's right.
Well, you guys met on his podcast.
That's right. It just occurred to me. That's right. I wanted to know what films you had in mind for the next Wayne Federman International
Film
Festival.
Well, again, he doesn't know the festival because it's not about the films.
Right.
It's about the comedians.
It's about the
comedian. Mark.
I made the same mistake, Mark. Don't worry.
Yeah.
You got the Federman anger. Yeah. How was that? Was it uncomfortable?
This short guy over here.
Wait, why am I being taken out? What's going on? Well, there you go.
So this is what's going on. It was done at Cine Family for 5 years. And as I said before, Gary kicked it off in an incredible way. And Cine Family closed because of a sexual harassment. How would you describe it?
Ugh. Well,
sexual misconduct controversy and some mismanagement, right?
A combination of, a combination of those things.
Well, it should stay open.
Protecting people who constantly were doing stuff. Yeah.
Right. So the theater is closed. So that's where I did it. And I mean, I would love to do it. I'm going to put it out in the manifest way. I'd love to do it at the New Beverly.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I would like to do it. If you're listening, QT.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in the meantime, I do it once a year in New York as part of the New York Comedy Festival. But I only do like one or two screenings. Mm-hmm. We had Julie Klausner After Hours.
Oh, you know? I love. Yeah, we talk about that all the time.
You do? You like
that? Love After Hours.
Well, Dana Gould. Yeah.
Oh, okay. What does that mean, Dana Gould?
He loves that actor.
Oh, Griffin Dunne.
Yeah. So we talked about, that's an awesome.
So she did that. Janine Garofalo did The Hot Rock. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie. Oh, it's incredible 70s movie with Robert Redford, George Segal. It's incredible. And then Larry Wilmore did The Parallax View.
Oh, right.
Nice. So it's been
That's
really
awesome.
Fun. Oh, and then just last year, Brian Regan did Midnight Run.
Oh,
Martin Brest.
Yeah. It's always comedians picking.
Always comedians. As a rule, it's a comedian. Yeah. Sometimes we'll do a comedic actor.
Right.
But as a rule, it's a comedian.
Who's the youngest comedian who chose the most recent film?
Oh, was the most recent film shown?
Yeah, that someone picked as like,
well, I don't know if it's
going
to be the youngest. Yeah. I mean, I know Zach Galifianakis did a Blue Ruin. Do you know?
I don't know Blue Ruin.
Yeah, it's like this violent, wonderful little independent movie. Not Kumail. No, it is Kumail Nanjiani.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did The descent. I like to call it the descent because that seems like the way it's spelled. But yeah, so that's, he loved. That's pretty recent.
Some horror movies. Yeah. A lot of horror. That's interesting.
No, there is. There's been a number of horrors. Kathy Griffin did the
Her
Dead
stand-up?
Zone. No, I think the Dead Zone something like that.
Ooh.
Yeah. So
did Kumail say why he liked The Descent?
Yeah. Well, first of all, he was blown away by the movie, by the filmmaking, by the story completely. And that I think he likes that genre as well. I know he does an X-Files podcast.
Oh, right. It's a very X-Files-y, yeah.
I think he just liked the fact that it was, I don't know. I mean, and the director showed up and he came on. It was an incredible night.
Do you have the comedian on stage saying why they picked the movie?
This is how it works.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I bring him out. I'm like, hey, we're going to show a little about why I picked the movie. And then we'll riff a little bit and then show the movie. They'll sit and watch. And then at the end, come up and go, I didn't remember that. Or I'm sorry, that was so boring. Or, you know, and then people will ask questions, very interactive with the audience. It's not podcast. It's just for that night.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just a blast to do. And I'm a film, you know, I'm a little bit of a film nerd.
Yeah.
So it was great for me. And I got to see some films that, a couple of films I had never seen before. Margaret Cho showed Darling, which I'm sure you've never heard of, a John Schlesinger film from 1965. That's incredible. Yeah. Incredible British movie. So,
has anyone done a documentary?
That's
a ground to be broken.
Nah, no one has
by
done
the
a,
next Wynn Film Festival.
Is it documentary or documentary?
Well, the Australians would say doco.
A document. Doco.
I like this doco.
All right.
I think documentary.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
What I say?
Documentary.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know.
Tree. But I say tree. Like I say like tree. Yeah. Yeah, like a tree.
Let's keep going.
Well, one thing that the people that are listening to this don't know is that we have in our hands and before us this Gary Shandling Memorial booklet that was handed out at his memorial.
Correct.
And this you were saying before, which neither George and I knew, is the impetus to the documentary?
I believe it is.
And the photo of you and Gary is from that film festival, right?
Yes.
Yes,
that is. I'm in there a couple of times. You have to look very carefully. Right. It's all about me and when in his memorial.
In my copy, you have post-it notes on the pages you're in. Yeah.
So everything else is sort of scratched out.
But also, the scans of his journals, which is, that's what makes this film really pop,
it's
too.
It's incredible.
Just having all of that personal insight.
Well, I will tell you a little something about the scan, because you can see that his handwriting sometimes is for him. So it wasn't ever that we did kind of reanimate the reanimator a little bit, so it was a little clearer. Just for clarity.
Crisping it up a little.
Yeah, a little bit. So that
and like that method of like the kind of the Michael Cera voiceover.
Yeah.
And then you kind of see the text unfold onto the page. Yeah. It's a really cool effect.
Oh, it's brilliant. And it seems like
Charlie Rose.
I know. And so many people from the time we started the documentary that whole Me Too avalanche happened.
There was a piece that someone wrote who was a female writer on the show, and maybe we can address that. I'm blanking on her name right now, but I can put a link to it in the show notes about how she felt like, you know, the mentor, everyone's talking about what a great mentor he was, and she did not feel
that way.
And that's represented, I think, especially I was thinking about this when we talk about the National Lampoon documentary about like how, you know, marginalized women were in that scene. And like, that's just maybe a product of this era, but it is interesting. Yeah. Like a lot of stuff's happened in the last, I mean, the fact that Brad Grey came up with Harvey Weinstein is also interesting.
I had no idea.
I did not know that either.
Yeah.
Buffalo.
You keep asking me I was like, what?
Yeah.
And that picture of Weinstein is shocking.
Yeah. He kind of looks like Seth Rogen.
Like a he does. Members only jacket, I think. Yeah.
With those classic
I don't
want to
be a member.
And out of the Buffalo music scene?
Well, yeah. So Brad Grey came out. We got to touch on that, too. But we're jumping around. Let's say we were talking about how this book came together within a month. The memorial was within a month of him passing
away. I think it might have been 6 weeks from the time he passed. And so so Judd started looking through pictures, and we were just like, Judd was in charge of putting together the memorial service. So he actually wrote a little skit. You don't see it in the documentary that Jeffrey Tambor does at the beginning. Very Larry Sanders-esque. It was just beautiful. And they talk about Brad. He talks about Brad Gray. Is he there? Because he has something he wants to pitch to him. You know, it was like, it was just a great thing. So he wanted to put this booklet together, and I guess he got Universal to pay for it.
Wow.
Judd, he's like great at the business.
Yeah.
He's great. He has a sense of it. And so as he was putting, he started going through these diaries, which no one had ever read. And it was like, oh my God, these quotes are incredible. It's about stand up and be yourself and how not to be nervous and
fear.
And all of that stuff. So he says, I'm going to put these in this book. And so between that, this little book, and putting together video clip packages to play in between the speakers, that was the impetus for the documentary. Mm-hmm. And he pitched it to an outfit called Home Box Office.
Yeah. A little upstart. Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but it was just the perfect. I mean, obviously, that's where Larry Sanders' show was, and they had just bought the rights back to it.
Yeah.
So it was, but they were as supportive. It was like a dream.
Yeah.
It was like whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Want to make it 90 minutes? 90 minutes. You want to make it longer? Whatever you think this should be, do it.
Yeah.
And so that's
awesome.
It's hard to find.
That is.
Yeah.
That's a lot. There's a lot of
love. So that's one of the reasons I think the documentary is as good as it is.
That's awesome. That the Kevin Nealon eulogy just brought me to tears when I watched this. Like the entire doc, I was like, this is awesome. And there's some beautiful moments, but his eulogy was incredible.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. I'm so glad.
Those jokes are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, perfectly crafted jokes that you might think of like you would have done over years to get the wording correctly.
Right.
The albatross around. I mean, it was just.
I know. It was perfect. And excuse me, I don't really know the timeline, but did Brad die after Gary? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He died while we were making the documentary.
Got it. And that's. Boy, that's a tough one because they seem like brothers. They seem really close.
Picture them in bed together, like hugging.
Yeah.
I mean, they built that whole empire together.
Right. Yeah. And then there was some snafu with money and.
It wasn't only money. It's in the documentary, but there's a huge break between Brad Gray, who is now this mega producer. He's doing The Soprano, you know.
Yeah.
It was just heartbreaking for Gary.
Right.
And he went after him.
Yeah.
And then Brad Gray came after him twice as hard.
Twice as hard.
With
wiretapping and private investigators. And
you know, whisper campaigns and this guy's crazy and all of that stuff. I mean, it was.
And then,
it really, shocked.
That is
But I have
shocking.
To say, Gary did go after him.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm not defending Brad, but I'm saying. He did sue him for $100 million. That's
a lot of money.
That's your company.
Yeah, and it's your reputation's pretty much everything, you know.
He was like, oh, you want to play?
Yeah,
I just assumed that was it.
Yeah, you want to dance? You feeling froggy?
Yeah. I mean, it was intense. And I don't know if I don't know if that clip is in the documentary, but...
Oh, you've seen stuff that's on the cutting room floor of this.
Yeah, I know Jay said that Jay Leno felt like that Gary was never the same after that. That might have, at one time we had that in there, and I kind of agree with that.
Yeah.
It was just never, you can see it in the doc, right?
Yes, of course. That definitely was.
What do you see?
Like,
I'm just curious, because I'm so close to this.
Yeah. Right. Because I didn't remember any of that lawsuit stuff. I just kind of remember Gary kind of going away for a while.
Right.
In the public eye. Maybe some of that whisper campaign stuff even got to like the casual fan. Because like what happened? Did he get a little nuts? He was being paranoid, but he was being wiretapped. So it was accurate.
Of course.
There's a part of the documentary where someone's talking. They're like, we thought he was crazy because he was saying he was hearing clicking noises on the phone and telling people he thought he was being wiretapped.
Right.
And they're like, Gary's gone crazy.
Yeah.
As it turns out, nope. He knew what he was talking about. Yeah. That's insanity. I can't imagine.
But yeah, no, that would be very traumatic for having someone you came up with who like was like, I don't know, I guess like your co-producer on your show. Was he also a co-producer on the first show on the Gary Shandling?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So just the whole time taking cuts, being his manager and being a producer and poaching talent. That was the part I didn't know.
Yes,
poaching talent for other shows.
That was the big part.
That's really
low down.
Uncouth.
Because he now doesn't have Gary's interests.
Right.
Yep. Right.
Right. Yeah. So, and he's the manager. And then there's
which is his job.
Yeah, which is his fucking job. And there's an amazing scene.
Are managers supposed to have your interests? I haven't
figured that out yet. But there's that scene in the Larry Sanders Show. Oh, I think this is in the doc as well. But Bob Odenkirk is Larry's agent.
Playing basically a Brad Garrett
version.
Character.
Yeah. Okay.
And he was like, fuck you. I never want to talk to you again. Goodbye. And then he's like, don't we have a meeting? And like, he's like, yeah. So how's the wife? How's the kid? It's fucking
right,
awesome.
I'm sure that was part of that.
Yeah, that is awesome.
Yeah, that was too bad that happened.
Yeah.
And I do think it really affected him. Sure. I really do. But then also, I mean, there was a number of things. That, the movie he did with Mike Nichols, the movie he wrote, I think also.
And I mean, I think it seems like in the diaries, there's even these lines where he's like, at a certain point, I think Brad has a surgery or something, and or something happens, and he's just like, forgive him. Or like,
he's telling himself,
like, the most Buddhist shit he can do, just be like, he is who he is. You know, we were close at one point. Like, I don't begrudge. We settled this. I don't begrudge
100%.
I
mean, that's
very hard. That's the hardest thing, is to let go of grudges.
Of course.
Yeah. It's really like, that is like the most Buddhist stuff you can get to. And I think that I think if you didn't have the framing device of like calling this like the Zen Diaries, then it's just like kind of like a showbiz documentary that you're used to seeing. This really gives you an angle on the whole thing, I think.
No question. And I think when we started finding those diary notes and put them in this booklet right here that I'm holding, that was the epiphany of like, oh, this is how we tell his story.
Right.
And his words.
Right. And also even the way he was saying, like the way the fight with Brad Gray, he's like, I'm standing up. Or a lot of times I think there's other things where he's like, I'm standing up for myself. It's not about vengeance. And I think it's like, you can forgive someone after you've stood up for yourself, but you still need to like, you can't just like be like, I'm just gonna. And I think that might be as a very West Coast thing. I'm like, you know, maybe they didn't treat me so great, but they're gonna do something for me. Or like, you know, you just like let that shit.
It's the whatevering of things that happen in your life.
But also, I mean, don't forget, he also picked up boxing late in his life.
I was gonna ask about that too.
Yeah, like, how is it? I was like, always fascinated by that because I've tried boxing and it's horrible.
Yes.
Somebody's punching you in the face.
It's 30 seconds of boxing is like an hour of running.
First of all, it's exhausting. Besides the exercise, but just the psychology of someone just attacking you, and that you have to let all of that, like taking the punch and giving a punch are supposed to be the same
thing. Let's talk about Alec Baldwin scenes.
Especially when it's Alec Baldwin punching you.
Alec is really hitting Gary.
Yeah,
like
he is.
You see it, it's even more in the DVD extra. You can see how much Gary is shocked how strong he is.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want to get punched by Alec Baldwin, honestly. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that or Long Gary Island anger of just like,
blue collar
like seven
swinging.
Brothers or something. I don't want to brawl with that. Yeah.
And he seems like a pretty competitive person, Alec Baldwin. Like, it's he's not going to just like go soft.
He says it.
Yeah.
He said it. I mean, that was the most amazing thing, that like when he gets on a set, he wants to destroy everyone. And
well, yeah. So, like, I remember watching that DVD extra and being kind of confused. I'm like, I thought Gary was all zen now. Well, he's real into like beating people up or getting beat up.
I think there is a zen thing to boxing.
Right.
Well, it's like there's a meditation involved because you can't think of anything else.
You know? Right.
Like,
you have to be purely
in it. You're in the now.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about basketball. Like, that's why I like to play basketball, because everything else goes away. And you're just thinking about what you're going to do with this defender on you and if you can shoot over him.
Right. Or like there's a flow to these things.
Yeah, and there's a flow.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone's like, if you're into Zen stuff too, like, I think you just want to achieve some kind of flow.
Yeah.
Flow states.
I mean, I could see boxing being meditative and like hurtful.
Well, when did the thyroid issue come up? Because I was also thinking, like, you get head injuries with boxing too, and that can, like, you know, just like with like football players or like whatever, anything like that.
Of course. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they wear the headgear, so I don't know if it's quite the. But I would think Yeah. Your brain would be rattled a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing we have yet to talk about is his brother. Mm-hmm. And so what I got from watching this doc, and I didn't realize about Barry, his brother, who died of cystic fibrosis, is that later on in life, if you haven't dealt with it well enough, anybody that you let in close, very close to you, and I imagine people like that, like Gary, didn't let a lot of people close. But if you do, and then they do something that pisses you off, or it feels like disloyalty is like a big scar in your life.
The abandonment issues, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Which explains the Brad Gray stuff, which is like, I let you in and you are picking other people over me. Like, where's the fucking loyalty? Fuck you. $100 million lawsuit, you know?
And like the brother aspect of it, right? Yeah. It's like this, you talk about recreating the familial environment. And I think, like Sarah said it, I think it comes up a couple other times in here. And I think a lot of people, maybe just in general, but also I know like in like music and comedy and stuff, like you kind of had a rough relationship with your birth family. Yeah. So you're just kind of trying to recreate something with the chosen family.
You can't fake it in the ring. You've got to really know yourself. And the punching and getting punched has to be won. It's a very soul-searching, Zen kind of experience because you have somebody throwing punches at you and you have to transcend that, which is like transcending life.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
To get to know an icon in the career that you chose as well, like that happens almost to no one, you know, like that's very lucky.
No, he was very supportive. And you can see even at the end, like when he got on Twitter, like when I did the Tonight Show, he Twittered about that. And I wrote this article and he sent something out about that I wrote about Richard Pryor. And he was just he's just great.
And I'm sure he'd be extremely proud of your book. You have a book about Pistol Pete.
Yeah, Maravich. Yes, he knows about the. Yeah, he did. He was. He was just very. Again, I feel like the part where he went away was very much helping other people, not just me. And obviously, you can see.
Right.
Well, it wasn't just me.
And didn't he have a note in the doc that says, "I just want to help people"? Mm-hmm.
Like mentoring people a mentor.
Yeah. And it was really an active thing. It wasn't like, he walked it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
I didn't even know that. Yeah. Like Sacha Baron Cohen was someone that was close to him. That was surprising to me.
Me too. So there's something that Sacha says. This was actually another question from my friend Bert who wanted to ask if you knew what this was. But Sacha says in the doc that he helped him. Sacha says he helped me, but he doesn't say what he did for him.
Oh. Well, I think it was for Borat, and God, what was it? I know Sasha's talked about it before, but there was some reshoot or something for Borat that kind of tied it together in a way. Yeah, I know it was Borat. It was definitely Borat.
Yeah. It was
like a script thing or something.
Because there was so much footage they had for Borat. I'm like, we know this is funny. Like, how can we make this arc work?
Right. because he says in the doc about watching it, I think he said he was on the BBC Four or whatever, mm-hmm. and like his friends were
watching the show, right?
Yeah, yeah, watching Larry Sanders' show, and his friends were all into it, and yeah, that's awesome. Because I mean, just to get help when you're, I don't know how old Sasha was when he made Borat, but like just coming up and having someone
well,
like
I'm sure, you know, 30, you know, so. You never really, because I'm over here, like you'd never. Like those guys in England, they so look up to like big American
they
stars.
They love Larry David too.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
such a British type of humor, Larry David.
Of course,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Have you seen that doc where the guy gets accused of murder and he goes to Dodger Stadium? And
I know the story.
Yeah.
I know the story. I have not seen the doc, but I do know that Larry David saved that guy's life.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I know.
Especially if you know Larry David.
But yeah, like, yeah, so that was a surprising mentee figure. Mm-hmm. And like, did you feel like you had like some specific mentors or did you have a mentor relationship with Gary? Definitely him and Judd have like a very mentor.
Well, I feel like they're almost like, mm-hmm. sometimes it's father, son, sometimes it's a brother, brother mm-hmm. situation where, no, I mean, not really. I wasn't, I mean, wherever I could get inspiration, I would try to get, but I would say Gary helped me quite a bit, mm-hmm. especially in like, and stand up and trying to cut away any kind of artifice, which is a really hard thing to do.
Very hard.
Really difficult.
Especially if you like doing silly comedy. Like yeah. silliness kind of has an artifice to it.
Yeah. And he was great. He was a great joke writer. And, you know, when he would go on Bill Maher, I would help him like prepare for that kind of stuff. And we'd banter some stuff back and forth.
Oh, wow. Did you meet Judd on the Larry Sanders
show? Oh, no. The Judd Fetterman story is amazing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, I just heard him leave you a voicemail earlier. Yeah.
He is the first person I met when I went out to California in the end of 85 in a fact-finding mission.
Whoa.
Fact-finding, like, can I do this? So I went to the improv Comedy Store in the Laugh Factory, and I think the first one was the Laugh Factory, and Judd Apatow, who was a freshman at USC, was hanging out in front of it looking for acts to book at USC.
What?
And booked me at USC.
What?
Yeah.
How long have you been doing stand-up at that point? About
4 or 5 years. He knew about me. He knew of who I was.
He heard about you.
Yeah, and it was like, do you want to do this? So we got booked at USC, Bovard Auditorium.
Wow.
And it was myself, Kevin Nealon. The first time I met, this is pre-SNL, Kevin Nealon, and a guy named Tommy Sledge, and there was one other act I can't remember. And that was the start of a like friendship with Judd. I obviously, helped him on this.
Wow.
I did an episode of Crashing. I mean, it's been an amazing relationship. I'm like, thank God I was nice to that kid. That's all I can say.
You never know.
Thank God. God,
dude,
little virgin,
you really
this little freshman,
yeah.
But yeah,
that's awesome. Wow, that's really cool that you guys maintain the friendship after you know.
I know we have a good thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you came out of Florida.
I came out of went to NYU Drama and started my stand up career in New York.
Yep. Got it.
Yep.
Oh wow. And Judd is out of New York, right? Or did he?
Syosset, New York, and then went to USC, and then stayed out here.
Crazy.
So we used to do stand up together and write stand up together. And but even like when I think about it, I know this is a tangent, but when I think about it, he was even at that time again booking USC, and then they had this other gig where he would book UC Santa Barbara and Sammy Shore, who was the guy who started the Comedy Store and got divorced from Mitzi. He had a room in Marina Del Rey that Judd was booking. He was like 20 or something.
Wow.
So he always had like a dual, like he could always write his comedy and do that, but he also had kind of a producing, helping other people.
Right, right.
And situation. And that continues with Amy Schumer and,
right.
you know, yeah. all of this.
And even Pete Holmes now and Crash. So you're on this season of Crashing?
Yes. Yeah.
I've seen Pete walk his dog in my neighborhood. I guess we're kind of neighbors. Oh, yeah.
Good story. That's a good story.
It's a good story. Yeah, that's fascinating.
That's incredible.
It's not a Pico Rivera story. It's a more of a.
Who does it say more about that Judd and Gary were close for all those years? Like, I mean, it seems like getting close to Gary meant like if you made a wrong turn somewhere.
I think Judd figured out Gary right away. I think Judd figured out how to be part of this, and like he directed an episode of the Larry Sanders Show, so like that's how much like Gary loved him.
Yeah.
And also Judd had his own career going. He was doing The Critic or some cartoon at the time, he couldn't work full time on Larry Sanders. But can I tell real quickly? I remember when Judd met Gary because I think they might have had the same manager or something. I'm not sure. And he was pitched to him as a joke writer to help him write the Grammy Awards. You know, this kid, he goes, so Gary was like, can you give me like a page of jokes, like just how you think and stuff? And Judd, and this is a great lesson for anyone, wrote like 100 jokes, wrote like 8 pages of jokes or something.
Yeah.
And all of them were, even if the punchlines weren't good, Gary was like, oh, I like this premise and I'll fix it and stuff like that. But I'm just saying, like, people who want to get in show business, go above and beyond.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Do more than you're asked.
Yeah. And that was the start of it.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
I know. No, it is.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that. I mean, it was like,
No.
I would try to write like... trying to get 12 good jokes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you have to have some brashness and some balls. Gary famously went to see Carlin.
Yeah. Same story.
Same kind of thing, which is like, you know, how do I do this? And he's like, these are my jokes. Like, man, I don't know if I'd be able to do that with like someone that I really look up to and be like, here's my jokes. What do you think?
If you said it like that, probably.
Yeah. Although, you probably don't remember this, but I hosted a show at the Improv that you were on.
Yeah.
And you and Judd were talking, and then I was standing there in awe, and you said, what kind of jokes do you do? Do you remember that? You probably don't remember that. To me. And I was like, I don't want to answer that question.
Oh, no.
That's too much. No, it's fine. You're being funny. I just like, that's too much.
Sounds like a dick thing.
No.
Sounds horrible.
No, it was fine. It was.
We know where you live now.
I know. I put up this image of this nice guy, and it turns out I'm horrible.
Do you know anything about this picture here with Gary and George H.W. Bush? It's did he do like a roast or something?
No. He did the
correspondence dinner.
Yeah. No, he did the correspondence dinner. Okay.
I don't know if it was the correspondence. It was something like that. There's a couple of press events with the president. Mm-hmm. And he brought Gary in and he kind of roasted him a little bit and in a very funny way. And it's a different time back then.
Yeah.
Presidents.
Now we have a president.
When the
presidents
actually go to.
Exactly.
Well, they go to the events. And I was talking to Dana Carvey about that. I hate to drop a name about because he did the same thing with,
did the impression of.
Yeah, he did an impression of him. But by the end, Dana Carvey was the last goodbye to his staff at the White House. He brought in Dana Carvey.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Like, you couldn't imagine. Yeah. Trump bringing in Alec Baldwin.
That would be insane.
That'd be nuts.
I love that scene, too, in the doc where Dana Carvey's doing his impression.
Just to show you how talented Dana Carvey is.
Yeah.
He is so talented.
He is a very talented guy. Yeah. But that scene is fucking hysterical because Gary plays it so well with his like, no, I'm fine with it, but I'm not. Like,
Roy London, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
Roy London.
It also is incredible to me that like someone like myself, if I got a writing job on Sanford and Son, I would have just stuck with it until the end of time, until they took me out of the writer's room. And someone like Gary, who's like, this isn't enough. This is not what I want to do. Like, I need to keep pushing, keep getting moving forward. Like,
well, that was, again, let's go back to our original question. Was there anything I learned? That was another thing that I never really put together was he would do something and then quit.
Right.
He did the Tonight Show and quit. He'd do this show and stop.
Yeah.
Did Larry Sanders. He stopped that show.
See, I didn't
know
that.
Not HBO.
Right.
You know, he just couldn't do it anymore. And then, and he did 2 stand-up specials and stopped. So that was his,
That was his thing.
He wanted to just refocus on something.
Yeah. That's pretty incredible.
Right? That's incredible. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I'd be a staff writer on,
Of course. I mean, to me, I'm like,
it's a dream job. People give up. People get divorced to get a, I don't need you in my life anymore. No. I now have a staff job.
Yeah. I mean, that level of comfort is enough to keep me satiated forever, where I'm like, I did it. I'm a staff writer somewhere. Yeah. Have you done a staff writer on a show?
No. I've never tried to.
Yeah.
Never tried. I mean, I was the head monologue writer on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. That's as close to
that's
everyday kind of doing jokes situation.
How does that work? I'm fascinated by monologue writers.
Well, I'm fascinating.
Yeah, you are. And you are fascinating. But how does that work? Like,
this is when it was in New York and you were out there for a little bit.
I went to launch the show. It brought me out to launch the show.
I didn't know that. I'm seriously fascinated because when I was growing up, my favorite part of Letterman, because I'm a huge Letterman fan, was his monologue. And I was wondering, like, how does that work every day? Like, what do you do? Like,
there's usually a head guy who's has the confidence of the performer. And then a bunch of writers who pitch jokes on topics. We send out the night before. I know this, we're tangenting this, but it is in a way connected to Larry Sanders. Yeah. And that we would send out topics from the news. And some people would write the night before. And then in the morning, more topics, you know, whatever. You know, Bill Clinton went to Ireland or, and those jokes kind of write themselves. Right. And then they would pitch a bunch of jokes, and I would decide which ones I like. I'd bring them in. Jimmy would look at them and go, I like these, and these. And then let's pitch out some more jokes for the afternoon and then put together a monologue. Well, Jimmy would try them out in front of an audience, but others would just, like Leno, would just kind of look and circle, like, I'll do this. And then you put them in an order. How's that look? And, we'd go, no, yes.
And then when they're taping that, do you just go back and start writing more, or is there any time off between?
No, I mean, there's jokes that go out there. I mean, there's topics that you can write on the night before.
Yeah,
it's very much a, what's the word for it? Groundhog Day job.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, we just did this.
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing it again.
Yeah.
Oh, we're writing jokes again.
Yeah.
What's happening today? We're writing jokes.
And if they have...
they are, in a way, all the same. I hate to say it. I mean, there's many different angles to it, but it's all like, it's going to be...
Right. Well, in the era that we're in now, I think I've heard people like Lori Kilmartin talk about this too, because she does it for Conan. It's like, now you're competing with Twitter. Now it's like, you got to make...
You feel like it's a higher bar?
It's just like you... I guess it's a difference of like anytime something happens, there will be so many jokes on Twitter that you really have to like A to C or like A to D. Like you need to like not just get all the low hanging fruit out of the way and then go for something that's not obvious.
Oh, interesting.
Because a lot of the obvious jokes are just going to get made on Twitter right away.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Crowdsourcing it.
But it's like, that's like in the era before Twitter, then there was like sometimes in the shows that were daily would have similar monologue jokes just by default of like you're picking from parallel thinking.
Of course.
That's interesting.
When At Midnight did the hashtag games, it was like that was the thing. I'm like, don't do the obvious thing first because everyone's going to do the most obvious thing. So you really kind of like.
Did you play that?
I did a little bit. Paco got on one of those.
Yeah, I did for Snowy Celebrity. I wrote Leonardo de Crapitz Cold.
I mean, it's all puns also.
Yeah.
It's just also, I love puns.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But, and the other thing I was surprised about in this doc is his near-death experience, which seemed to have, like, a huge ramification on, like, the rest of his life.
You mean, when the car accident?
Yeah, the car accident. Yeah, which is, that would profoundly affect pretty much everybody. But that seemed to have a real effect on Gary and kind of the, like, fuck, I could have died, so let's... let's do everything now.
I know. And he also has a crazy, I'm going to strike the word crazy, as a very shockingly metaphysical experience where he hears a voice
and
says, do you want to keep living Gary Shanley's life?
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Right.
And he told that story. So it's not. So
yeah.
How would that affect you?
Yeah, that would affect me a lot.
He seems to even like write about himself in the third person a lot in his diaries, oh, which is fascinating. Like he's just like, whatever I do on stage will be Gary Shandling. I will do what Gary Shandling would do. He just has this like really interesting remove, like third person view of himself.
Right.
Which is good. You know, like, you need that kind of.
Can I tell you one quick thing that he told me that was the moment he has that scene with Carrie Fisher, seeing the banter with Carrie Fisher, and your parents were this, and Irv and Muriel Shandling, and that when he did that joke, and Carson laughs, and then laughs more, I don't know if you should really watch Carson in that bit, and in that moment, that Gary said that Carson told him that that was the moment he knew that he would be a good host for the show.
Oh, wow.
That it was a host kind of joke.
Yeah.
As opposed to just a stand-up joke.
Right. Wow.
And then he was hosting very shortly after that.
That's insane. Man, think of, like, Johnny's so clued in on that stuff. And he's like, that's the joke that's going to make you a host, kid.
Yeah, that you're capable of doing that kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was incredible.
Off the cuff material. That is very funny. That was very funny.
Yeah. It was
See?
But watch Carson if you watch that again. Watch his reaction to it.
Yeah.
He's really delighted because I think, he's thinking, in his mind, he's thinking, oh, what would I be saying? Mm-hmm. And like, this kid's got something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And Carson was so generous with young comedians. Think about it. I mean, you don't see anyone guest hosting. I mean, Letterman got sick a little bit. But
it's Joan Rivers, right, was the other one. But I guess that was like that all ended when she did her show. Right?
Yeah.
But I'm just saying you never saw a guest host isn't even a thing.
You're right.
Carson didn't care. It was like, I'm bad. I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
I'm fine.
Magnanimous.
And then they say that like he also was in a sketch. Carson was in a Larry Sanders sketch.
Yes. No, not in Larry Sanders. In the 25th anniversary special. I don't know. It was called the Gary Shandling. This was a special one-off. I think it was for Showtime.
Uh-huh.
And it was a fake talk. It pre-echoes Larry Sanders.
Right.
And he's doing a show, but it's an anniversary show.
25th anniversary
show. There's like early clips of him in black and white with the hair and stuff like that. And Carson was on that.
Oh,
that's awesome.
That is awesome. Yeah, they show like the talking horse and stuff.
Silly. It's actually pretty good. I know you mentioned Paul Wilson.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I love Paul Wilson. Yeah, Paul Wilson's one of my favorite. Just from the original Gary Shandling show, it's like he's the perfect foible, you know. Like, and then like Jeffrey Tambor, he keeps picking these great like antagonists and stuff for his stuff.
Incredible.
Yeah, that is incredible.
All right, so what else do we have?
We not much left other than like basically
talk about Mitzi. We talked about.
Yeah, I was just gonna say his mom. Like his mom was,
or like his relationship with women. I think you could template back to his mom, right?
I guess so. Yeah. That relationship. I feel like most male comedians have some tenuous relationship with their mom.
It felt very familiar to me.
Yes,
like some of that stuff felt very familiar.
Me too. Yeah, like that. Then I like when I first opened up this Gary Shandling memorial book, and it was like my mom wants me to have kids, but not with other women. One of the funniest fucking lines, man. It's awesome. Because that just wraps it up in a nutshell. Yeah. Well, this has been awesome.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's been so great. Thank you for having us in your new home and sharing these stories with us.
You're going to have cold food. You're going to have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Wi-Fi was just installed. It was, at the beginning of this podcast, I didn't have Wi-Fi.
As soon as
I get off, I'm going to
put
it in my...
That's what SupDoc can do for you.
Yeah.
And also, you are our first... repeat guest.
What?
Yeah.
Like we've had two-part episodes.
Yeah.
No, Adam Fowler, but then that one was a live show. So first repeat guest, like where it's just all about
and
you.
And again, I'm going to echo what I said at the beginning, which is I was hesitant to do this because I feel like I don't want to take credit.
Yeah.
Even though I do have a screen credit and I was involved with this, there was other people that really were nuts and bolts. It was a year from the time he decided to do this, of just finding footage, going through the diaries, before we even shot any interviews or anything, a year of trying to find that footage.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing.
Were you on set for any of the interviews?
Yeah. Okay. For most
so
of
you
were, most...
Okay, so that's why you have a credit. Come on.
Yeah. No, no, no. I'm not... But I'm saying there were people... right. I didn't go through his diaries.
Right.
I didn't find all that footage and decide and... like the. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Got it.
It is really very much Judd's vision of it, and other people did way more producing than I did.
Right on. Well, thank you for having us, and this was awesome.
Welcome to my home.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scoble.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.